Good morning. Can y'all hear me?
The numbers get smaller. Disney? So first off, just a reminder, assignment 3 is due today. What? Did I not delete? Oh, I thought I had deleted the past ones. I tried to remember it deleted, and it's like, yes, it is finalized. It has not changed in days. Okay, let's just. I stick in that this assignment has not been finalized when I'm busy still editing it. And then I say, oh, TAs, look at it. And then, okay, it's removed. If you're ever curious about whether something's finalized, just look at the history of the page. You can see when the last edit was done. Yes? Sorry, I can't hear you. Only 2 submissions. What? Okay, I will try to investigate what that is. So it looks like there are there's duplicated assignments for assignment 3, so you can submit in 2 places.
Would it matter if we submitted?
If I have 2, it actually might matter. Hold on, no one said anything about this. Okay, look, what? How do I know? That makes no sense. Okay, let's see. Okay, I'm checking real quick. See what's there. Yes, you're right. There are.
There's 2. The first one has 16 and the second one has 6. So just choose one. And we'll locate both of them. So it doesn't matter which one you submit it to, the marker will look at both of them.
Okay, I'm just trying to make sure that that says the same thing. Okay, this one is.
Yeah, they're both at the same time.
Okay, they're both at the same time. So what I'm going to do is duplicate, don't use. Okay, now the second one said, if you reload the page, do you see the.
Yeah, there's 6 people that have already put it in there, though.
So I know. Well, we can even contact them to have them submit it to the other one. Send them email. But anyway, so now you'll see the second one says duplicate, don't use. If you ever see weird things that don't make sense, tell me. I have no idea how 2 got in. That makes no sense. I added one. Anyway. Yes? It's gone now. Because it turns out that CU Learn has a strange notion of Q&A. What Q&A is I'm supposed to put up questions, and then you get to see the answers once you've submitted your own answer to the question. So it's like a quiz or something where you sit and you see what everyone else answered to it. So it's like, okay, I get it, but it's like, yeah, I wasn't. I didn't realize what it was talking about. So it's gone. Just use the general discussion. But other administrative stuff, so yes. So assignment 3. So how do you feel that the tutorial and the assignment, how do you feel how they went together? Do you think they, you know, did doing the actual exercises with the scheduling help you understand what these different algorithms were? You know, kind of, yes, no?
I know for some of you it's kind of like, I got it before, I didn't have to do this.
Like, you are great. Some people need it helpful to work through these answers. Now, this is a reason why I did it in a tutorial as opposed to assigning it for a homework. But one thing is, if I assign it for a homework, that means that I couldn't have you use a simulator because the simulator gives you answers. I could have had you modify the simulator or code up the simulator, but that would have taken a lot of time to learn something that's kind of simple. So, anyway, trade-offs. So if you'll look at the class wiki, you will notice that I have assigned chapters for the rest of the semester. And as I mentioned, you should try reading these chapters before you come to class. So I'm just trying to get back here. Come on here. Here we go.
Now
so,
it's overwhelming to see all of them.
What? To see all of them? It's the whole textbook. But you'll notice how, if you've been keeping up with... So there's a couple of reasons why you should read it before coming to class. One is, my lectures make a lot more sense if you looked at the material. Two, if you fall behind, it's going to be painful to catch up. You don't want to read any textbook all at once, and certainly this one. I mean, yes, when you're preparing for the midterm, do you want to review the chapters? Sure. But you don't want that to be the first time you've looked at the textbook. You'll start having convulsions or something. I mean, it's just, no, don't do that. So I've tried to structure this class to help you go to the path of least resistance is to do things the way I ask. So other questions? Otherwise, let's start talking about address spaces, which I've already started talking to you about, and the chapter, so in some ways I jumped ahead of myself a little bit here. Totally following your textbook. You don't do it quite in the order you want. Oh, by the way, when you look at the wiki, you will notice that I follow the textbook order, except I jump ahead a bit to concurrency. You'll see that I don't complete everything on memory management. I complete everything on just about everything on memory management before the midterm, but I jump ahead to concurrency in the middle of it, and then do the more advanced topics later. The reason why I decided to do that was because I didn't want to be covering something as fundamental as concurrency just before the midterm and then have you tested on it. That seemed a bit, not nice. So instead, the concurrency is a few weeks earlier, and then the last bit will be some more memory manager stuff, which is more advanced. But again, it builds on the previous concepts, so it shouldn't be quite so easy to comprehend. There's a little bit of concurrency, the event-based stuff that I put till after the midterm. But then after the midterm, it's mostly file system, and block device stuff. And then second of all, look at the dialogues. I didn't link specifically to the dialogues in the textbook that precede each section, that precede and summarize each section, because I didn't link them because you're not really responsible for them, but they're useful to look at. So I'm not saying you shouldn't read them. It's just I'm trying to minimize the number of links to things that, yes, definitely look at this.
I don't think there's anything else.
So now, address spaces. So as we've talked about, address space, addresses in memory. I think in the book they actually start with address 0 at the top or the bottom.
Top, yeah.
That makes no sense to me, honestly. Because you always talk about memory that's bigger as high memory. And with the way I'm drawing it here, high memory would be at the bottom. So We'll see. Anyway, that's... I'll follow the conventions of the book, but it seems exactly opposite to the way I would do it. Let's try to be consistent. So in the book, they're talking about like a 64K address space, 16 bits, so 2 to the 16 minus 1, 655350. Very small address space. This is the kind of address space that you would have on something like a Commodore 64 or an Apple II, personal computers from the 1980s, or if you're talking about older computers, you're talking about things in the mid-60s, I think. So the 1960s, then we're talking about like 64K of RAM. This is not that much memory, certainly by modern standards. So if you have RAM, you have an older system, you don't have much of it. What does an operating system look like in this context? And what does your program look like? So, classically, you say the OS is here, and code, and data here. Not necessarily we'll define the division between the two. Yes.
You say OS, but
So what they're saying is, so in the book they said, if you're talking about a system like this, where everything's in one address space, you don't have much memory, the operating system is effectively a library. It's not an OS in the modern sense. So why is that? So when we say library versus operating system, what's this distinction that we're having?
OS.
No. It's not just that an OS manages and a library doesn't, because I did call this an OS, but it's more like a library. So.
Control and scheduling.
So, yeah, control scheduling.
What was the question?
So the question is you have. If you're talking about a small address space, like 64K, you have an operating system in there, and you have a program running. The book says, in this sort of setup, the operating system is much more like a library, rather than saying it's a full operating system. And so, key to understanding this point is understanding, what do we mean by saying it's a library?
System calls, kernel?
Meaning,
syscalls. That's where the programs, the processes go to make system calls. That's what the code is.
That is certainly part of it. More what I'm trying to get at is, what is a library? When you say a library, what are you talking about? The library runs under the control of the program, whereas the OS doesn't. Under the control of, when you're executing the library code, this code is running. This code's in charge of, of things. When this code's running, it's running. When you say in charge, the thing to understand, when you say you have library code, library code is code typically that you did not write that is sitting in your address space. So this operating system code is code that the person writing your program did not write, but it's sitting in their address space. It got loaded in, it's there, the routines in there can be called, but so first approximation, it's opaque. I don't know how it works. I don't want to know exactly how it works. I just want it to do its job. I want it to follow its contract. I want it to follow its API. I'm going to call it to do something, and it should do whatever I ask. And that's what this, on older systems, that's what the operating system does. They're just routines called by a standard interface that's declared. You might call specific routines directly, or there might be a dispatcher, and you might pass it a number, and then it goes to calls the other routines. But it's just code that's co-equal with your application code. Meaning that, let's say you don't like something this operating system does, you just write your own routine to do it. Now, if you start doing that, of course, well, what happens if the operating system changes? Or what happens, you won't necessarily know exactly how to jump into it. It might mess up your assumption stuff. So your program potentially becomes very tied to the exact version of the operating system. Yeah, so just as in modern systems, this goes with libraries. When you call a library, you normally follow its API. And if you decide to deviate from that API and call routines directly in the library, accessing, say, private functions or private data structures, you can do it. It will work. But then when the library changes with the next release, whether it's a security fix or they add functionality or something, your code's going to break because you didn't access the part that the creators of that library promised to keep consistent. Now, that's exactly the same thing with this operating system. Now, when you used, on like an Apple II or a Commodore 64 or something, you would have the operating system be on the... So you wouldn't normally have a hard disk with everything that you run. You normally have floppy. And each floppy, you'd stick into the computer and you'd start it up and it would just load that floppy. On that, and it would load some program. There might be multiple programs in that disk, but when you stuck that disk in, it had the operating system on it as well. The operating system would first load off the disk and then it would allow you to run another program. Like there might be, basically, the first program you'd load off the disk would be a basic OS code and then a manager that might let you run another program. Or if it was a particularly big program, it would just go directly into the one program that's on that floppy. Every floppy would have a copy of the OS. Every bootable floppy would have a copy of this. You might have non-bootable floppies, like it might be data disks, or maybe a program would reside across multiple disks. And so you might even have a situation where you'd stick in the first floppy of a program, and then it would boot up that, and it would say, please insert the second disk. And you'd insert the second disk.
So what was the answer to your question?
So in those situations, so the reason why I was saying this is because what did you do if you want to do copy protection on games in this kind of situation? You wrote your own OS. Literally, you would make your own OS that would be loaded in, that would have its own funky disk format, that would do all kinds of crazy things. And so in order to copy the disk, you'd actually have to reverse engineer how that little operating system worked. Because these operating systems would have direct control over exactly how that floppy drive ran, exactly how it encoded the data on the disk. So you could do some really nasty tricks on those older machines because the operating system had such low level control and was a relatively small piece of code, so you could just take one, create one from scratch, or modify one. So really you should think of, on these systems, the OS is just a library. It's just a library that can do I/O stuff. It knows about disks, it knows about video, it knows about keyboards, maybe it knows about the mouse, but it has routines for making it easy to access those things. Might even provide some abstraction so you can use different kinds of disks or maybe different kinds of videos, and more likely different kinds of disks. But if you don't like it and you want to mess with it, or if you want to look inside of it, you can. It's all there. And in fact, if your program's not careful, you can overwrite the OS. It's just routines to help you. So this is all well and good when your program essentially controls the machine. You have the whole control of this. Now let's say though I want to run more than one program. If I run one more program, now instead of code and data, I'm going to be, this will be code one, be data one, then be code two, data two. We're all going to be stuck in the same address space and all intermixed. And if I want more memory, I'm going to have to figure out where is there a nice little space. space for me to get that memory? Is there a big enough contiguous block? Maybe not. Maybe they don't have to move someone else's stuff around. It's like, you know, you all, most of you probably share your living quarters with someone else. Or if you have it, you have it in the past. When you do so, when you make use of shared resources like a kitchen, you will find that there can be issues. I mean, it's one thing if one person takes a turn with the kitchen at once. That's fine. That's kind of that's equivalent to just running one program at a time on the system. But let's say more than one person wants to cook a meal at the same time. There's only so many pans. Only so, so many, spatulas and whatever. You get contention issues. And the larger the task you're trying to do, the more contention there is. If one person just wants to toast a Pop-Tart, the other person's like, cooking some French toast for breakfast, I mean, they're not going to overlap too much. Someone's going to use a toaster, the other people are going to use a pan or something, and it's all going to be nice and separate. But if two people want to cook separate Thanksgiving dinners at the same time in the same kitchen, it's not going to be a pleasant thing to behold for most people, most kitchens, because there just isn't enough resources to go around. You're going to sit there and say, hey, I need that spatula now. Something's burning here. Like, sorry, I'm flipping. You step on each other. So, if you go back to older systems, you'll find there's some fancy ways of doing this. But once we got the transistors to do something better, we decided to do something better because computers needed to run more than one program. They needed to have them run at the same time. They needed to have them share resources, but we didn't want them stepping on each other. So what did we do? So this is a biological reference, which so most of you might not get. But ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. So by two words you might not know. But what that says is, if you've ever looked at pictures of like how a fertilized egg turns into a full creature and all the stages it goes through, you might have seen some things where, oh, look, it looks kind of like a little tadpole. Oh, it looks kind of like a little fish. Oh, that looks kind of more like a reptile. It's got a tail or something. And then, oh, now it starts looking like a little monkey. So what this is saying is that the process that a living system goes through in terms of going from one cell to a full, full organism is kind of rehashes the evolutionary path it took, in that you see the remnants of where it was in the past. Like, the fact that it looks like a fish at one point was because we came from fish. And at one point, we have common ancestors with fish. So, and that common ancestor was more fish-like. So, yeah, we kind of look a bit like a fish at one point. But then that gets reconfigured into something else. This is exactly what happens with computer systems, in that everything that you see that is new is built on top of stuff that's old. Particularly in something like operating systems, which is highly evolutionary because you always want code to run. And so what is always happening is you take an older system, you hack on it, and you get a newer system. So really what happened was, is we had all these programs that assumed a world like this. They had an operating system, they had code, they had data, all sitting in one address space. We said, we'll keep that, and we'll run multiple programs just by making more of these. We'll give everyone their own address space. And everyone will have their code and data. Same thing, And this way we keep all the programs happy. In effect, what you see inside of a computer system is the remnants of the old primitive computers that we used to build. And in fact, actually, when you write your program, most of the time you're coding for a specific address space. So a first approximation, your program would run fine on an older operating system, just linked against a different OS, which would give you full access to the computer. So you're kind of running a bunch of Commodore 64s at once. So this is what we talk about when we talk about virtualization. Virtualization is really a technique of taking a program that has certain assumptions about the world, putting it in a little box, and saying, okay, your assumptions are going to hold in this box, even though everything outside this box is completely different. The world has completely changed behind your back, but you're too old and broken to know about it, so we're just going to keep you the same. This is exactly why biology does it. Backwards compatibility. You got to keep living the whole time. So you take whatever worked, you freeze it in amber, and then you build something around it. Now, if you look at, you know, why do biologists think that all life has a common ancestor? Well, one thing is very simple. So if you look at the basic metabolism of every cell, they all work in the same way. Like, how do we all process sugars? It's the same chemical pathway. I mean, it's got a bunch of arbitrary steps with a bunch of, you know, different kind of chemical transformations, but they're all the same chemical transformations conducted by the same basic enzyme. All the same. So I was like, well, if you did it all, did this completely arbitrary process in exactly the same way, it probably was done just once and everyone just copied it from there. This is what you see inside computers all the time. Like, why does a computer work like that? Someone did it at some point that way, and everyone copied it after that. And if you want to know who to blame, you just have to figure out who made the mistake first, and they copied it from there. Probably my favorite example is actually from the web. There is a field with those of you who took 24/6, you might remember this. Referrer header. Referrer is supposed to have two R's. I think that's correct. Yeah. But the one that's in the field only has one, F-E-R-E-R. So there's a misspelling. You want to correct it? Tough luck. Can't. Because systems all been built like this. So I don't know who put the first referrer header in. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Tim Berners-Lee. But whatever implementation did it, they misspelled it then. One programmer probably, I'm sure, made this mistake once. It got stuck in the protocol, and no one's been able to fix it since. Because everyone depends upon it. One character change. I mean, this is just dumb. One character change. Why not fix it? You can't. It's done. No, it's because everyone already expects it to be that way. If you change it now, they'll go like, well, is it this or is it this? It makes everyone's life more complicated. It's not worth the effort. That's why these things get stuck the way they are. So you'll see a lot of weirdnesses in any operating system. It's just there because it was there and it was too painful to change. Like, Vincent, why is that Unix command like that? Like, ls. Is that really a good name for listing the files in the directory? I mean, two characters is kind of cryptic. Why, you know, why is that? Well, it was chosen, and if you changed it, everything on Unix breaks. Because everyone expects to be able to list files like that.
Over time, though, imagine the amount of bits that would save by just taking that extra.
And imagine how many programs, yes, bits were saved, and imagine how much frustration there was about, like, don't even know. OCD people is funny. He's like, it's wrong. It's wrong. Why is it like this? And just, well, just imagine that. So what we did with the modern operating system, what we're going to be talking about for most of the next couple of weeks is how do you go from having one of these to a bunch of these and actually have the illusion work so that the entire, so your program really doesn't know the fact that these others are out there and running at the same time and sharing the same hardware. When we talk about virtual memory, what we're talking about is every program gets its own address space. But its own address space is a virtual address space. There is a real address space. There is the physical address space of the actual RAM chips that you actually installed in your computer. But no program actually refers to it directly except for the operating system. And even the operating system goes to great pains to try to access it directly as real memory as in as few places as possible. You access virtual memory, and then you have to rely on these things called page tables and such, and TLBs and everything to map it in real time on every memory access. So your program doesn't have to think about the real memory. Because otherwise you'd have to deal with that whole contention of everyone having to deal with the resource and go like, oh, you're over here, getting crowded out. Now, even if the computer is crowded, your program doesn't realize it. Now, you can see that can be a bit of a problem. There's no way for your program to see that the computer is running a bunch of other programs which are consuming huge amounts of resources. If you're in a kitchen and you see that there's four other people trying to cook a meal inside that, in that kitchen, you have the option to look at it and say, hey, I'm going to go out to eat. I will go elsewhere. Walk away. You can't do that here. Your program can't see that. It is literally blind to it. It's been given a completely altered reality where it can't see these other programs. If it wants to find out about these other programs, it's almost like it's sitting in a prison cell and it asks the OS saying, hey, is anyone else out there? I can't hear anything. I can't see anything, but, you know, oh, yeah, you know, we're full here. We've got thousands of, you know, people in here doing stuff. Really? It's so quiet. I mean, things are a little slow, but it's quiet. So that's all you can see. Now, one thing you should notice is the OS is still there. I didn't get rid of it. I didn't say, oh, there's no OS in these things. No, the OS is still there. It has to still be there. But we call it by something else. What do we call it? For the most Unix systems, you're talking about the C library. For Windows systems, you're talking about the Win32 DLL. It's a library. It's a library that is linked into your process, into your address space. So by the way, when we talk about processes, we're talking about these address spaces with some number of virtual CPUs attached to each of them. The process is one of these address spaces with one or more virtual CPUs. Single-threaded processes have one virtual CPU. Multi-threaded processes have multiple virtual CPUs associated with them. Has nothing to do with the number of cores on your box, because these are virtual. So this is a library. This is code that's linked into your address space. And this code knows how to access the larger operating system. So there's the OS here, and then there's the OS here. That's really in charge. And what's happening is this OS is communicating with that one. And so why do you want this here? Well, these guys could directly access it just like this. But for the same reason you had an operating system back when you had a single address space running the whole computer, you don't want to know the details. You want a clean API that takes care of the mess so that you don't have to. So this provides a clean API. This does the heavy lifting. What's the other name for this? This is the kernel. So when we talk about a full operating system, we're always really talking about
the kernel here plus the libraries that are loaded into the address space.
So if I'm talking about libraries that are loaded into an address space, which libraries are the operating system libraries and which libraries aren't? Because some libraries definitely part of the operating system. Well, what you could say is none of the libraries are part of the operating system. The only operating system there is the kernel. You can say that, but the problem is that no one talks directly to the kernel. It's like those older systems where can you talk directly to the hard disk, to the floppy drive? Yes, you can talk directly to the floppy drive. Do you want to? No, not most of the time. Unless you're trying to create some bizarre thing that no one else will be able to understand, like you're trying to copy protect your game. So let's say this is not. So something in here has to have some abstractions to know about this kernel, because this could change. There could be different kernels. So let's have a library that abstracts this. So you have to worry about what kernels we're running. But what services does this OS provide? Does this kernel provide? Now it may provide access to the disk. It may provide access to memory. It might provide access to a GPU or video hardware, maybe a secondary co-processor. You know, there's all this different hardware it can provide access to. At what level of abstraction does this stop? Do you stop it when you say, okay, the operating system provides access to graphics on the screen just as a set of bytes to put pixels in somewhere? So it's a simple memory frame buffer. Or is it a higher level library that provides windows and widgets and patterns of the mouse and cursors and stuff? Does it provide windowing? Does it provide compositing? Does it provide ability to rotate your desktop? These are all libraries that are they're provided in some way. There's a kernel here, OS here. And actually, this kernel may not want to do this, and it may, in fact, delegate some tasks to a special may delegate some stuff to a special process. So in order for, when this sends a message here, it's going to go to this other special process and do some stuff. Why do you do this? Because this gets too big. It's really tricky to code stuff in here. So you try to put as little as possible, but may want to provide some high-level functionality. So you dump stuff in another process. So where's the OS now? This is why people get so bent out of shape when they're talking about what an operating system is. It's because it's all, at the end of the day, it's a bit arbitrary. Where do you draw the line? Where do you say this functionality is in the operating system, this functionality isn't in the operating system? There's some functionality that's very clearly in there, which is the focus of this class, but when you start adding higher level services like modern mobile operating systems, and actually desktop operating systems, provide a embeddable web view object that provides standard ability to view web pages as a standard service. Windows provides as a standard service. iOS provides as a standard service. Android provides as a standard service. You can't easily change it because you install alternate browsers on most of these systems. Those alternate browsers can't necessarily replace that embeddable web view. But are we saying the web browser is part of the operating system now? Kind of is. But kind of big. It doesn't look like the other stuff we're talking about. But again, it's a question of the functionality that programs depend on. This all makes sense? I'm saying that the operating system What you define as the operating system changes over time depending upon how much functionality you depend on the system to give you. And that's okay. And in fact, what the general trend in operating systems is to provide higher level APIs. You'll find underneath those higher level APIs are the old stuff. You might say, well, why don't we optimize that old stuff and get rid of it? We don't need all those layers and stuff. Let's just simplify it so we just provide the higher level API. Why don't we do that? Evolution. Because there's still code that assumes the old ways. And if you were to get rid of those abstractions, you would break that code, and that would make some people unhappy, and so you don't see that. The only time you break those abstractions, typically, is when you make a new system. When iOS came out, Android came out, they changed a lot of how things worked. They changed some of the abstraction, the assumptions, but most of the code is actually code from older operating systems. So mostly they didn't break things. They only changed very relatively few things. We'll talk a bit about that later, what they changed.
Operating system libraries, the address
space, exactly. So here, inside the address space, these are general function calls. Calling the code here is just like calling any other code anywhere else in the address space. But you're trapped inside of this address space. How do you escape it? That's what a trap is, or a software interrupt or something. It's a mechanism that lets you access this code. Think of it like a, how do you access that other dimension? You have to have some sort of portal gun or something. You got to get out there and go over here. Trapping into kernel mode. When you talk about trapping into kernel mode, you're talking about going from here to here, having this do something, and then come back. Traps do not work like regular function calls because they have to change the state of the world. When you're running this, the regular process, the hardware is in a state such that this can run, and it can't access anything else. It can't access the hardware, can't access the other processes directly, because if it could, it could mess them up. So it can't even see them, can't do anything with them. But when you switch here, when I run this code, it's got to see everything. So the CPU has to change modes. We'll talk about this more later, but this is going from user mode to supervisor mode. That's what this transition is. This user mode to supervisor mode. Because in supervisor mode, the CPU allows everything to be accessed. In user mode, it's restricted based upon whatever was set up from supervisor mode. That switching is the trap is going into here. A context switch is going into here and going to another process. But again, if you get lost or confused about this, just remember the first abstraction for creating programs in machine code was the address space. And it was a thing that was actually embodied in hardware. It was built. That's what computers were put together. People then tried to run multiple programs inside that same address space and realized it was not pleasant. It was really annoying. So they then built hardware and built modern operating systems to manage that hardware so that we go back to giving every program its own address space, pretending like it had full access to a computer. But the full computer it has access to is this virtual thing, as opposed to real hardware. And we multiplex it, we switch it off using this operating system kernel. So how this happens, I expect to be, there should be that there's a lot of details here to figure out. We talked before about last week you should have heard about how the CPU is switched between things. Here we're talking about how memory is switched. Okay, so I'm going to take a break here, and then we will go back to, then we will continue. Okay, let's get started again.
So this is kind of the high level of what's happening here. What does your program see of this when you're talking about managing memory? Now, this is a little bit of a funny question, because in some sense, why do I have to do anything? I have my own computer. I have my own address space. I own it all. So what sort of...
So why is there memory allocation? Well, not so much system calls. It's like, yes, there are system calls, but system calls for accessing things like disk makes sense based on this model.
Because the operating system kernel controls the disk, and you have to ask it for permission to have it deal with the abstraction. I don't want to see blocks on the disk. I want to see files. But there's a certain API for dealing with memory in Unix, which is beyond just saying you're in your own address space. If you're running your program and you try to access arbitrary parts of your address space, what happens? Can you do it? Can your program just access any memory it wants? Because I said it's all boxed off, right? So if it's all boxed off, why can't I just access all the memory? Because it would mess up performance. What the operating system wants you to do is tell it you want some memory to be active. You tell it what memory it's going to be active, then it will say, okay, I will make that memory active. So how do you do that? How do you say what memory is going to be active? There's two basic ways. I'll talk about the more general mechanism because it's actually a little bit easier to understand. And then I'll talk about more specific mechanisms. So the first one is an MMAP.
Now, to a first approximation, when you initially have your process created, you could say it has no memory. So when you access memory that you, so ask the question I have, when you access memory that you have not specifically asked for, the operating system sends you a segmentation violation, a bus error, whatever. It sends an error to your process. And if you don't catch that error, that catch that signal, your process will terminate. Because the kernel is saying, you didn't tell me you wanted that memory.
So you could make an operating system that allow you to access any of the memory that you wanted, but you then have programs that would potentially grow in memory usage without bound and not. You generally need, I don't know, who knows, maybe one day we'll start building operating systems that work that way. But they don't work like this now.
When you say mmap, what you're saying is you have a draw representation of the disk. And here we have a file F.
So I have a file here on disk. When I do mmap,
I'm saying I want the bytes. Bytes on this file on disk to be mapped to a memory area. Typically, when you do mmap, you don't. I think actually you do specify the address range. So you specify an address range. You say, I want this file to be mapped to this part of memory. So what does it mean to be mapped? It means if you change this memory, it would be changed on disk if it's a writable map, but otherwise if it's a read-only map, then you can't write to this area of memory, but if you read any part of it, you access that corresponding part of the file. Yes,
So so yeah, exactly. They ask it to say, I want these byte range to be active. So one way it does so is through the mmap system call. And mmap says, here is a file. Make this file be in my address space. Now you might say, ooh, that sounds expensive. Because does that mean that it loads the entire file into memory when I do this call? And the fact is, no, it does not. That's the cool thing about it, is you may map. You can map a gigabyte file into your address space. If it's a gigabyte file, it would take up a gigabyte of memory in your address space. But if you only access one little part of it, it'll only load that one part. It'll take up space in your virtual address map. There'll be some overhead for doing that mapping. But otherwise, it won't actually load much data at all from disk. This is how libraries are handled. When you load the C library or any other library you access, this is true on Windows, on Linux, on Mac OS, the library is a file on disk. That file on disk is mapped to a part of the address space. This also happens for your executable. Your executable is not direct, although this isn't done directly through an mmap, although the underlying mechanism is the same, because this is what execve does. Execve maps the executable that's a file on disk onto here. And so as the program is accessed, it can be loaded on disk, potentially as demanded. So if you only use 10% of the code in your executable, only 10% of the code will be loaded into memory.
So you say libraries are based in disk, and then
So when you think of a map, you should think of this as a reference. It's saying that if you access this byte range in memory, go to this file and access this corresponding byte range in the file. Does it say load everything from the file to memory? No. It says do it as needed. Now, you might think, wait, if I only do it on every memory access, couldn't that be kind of slow if I'm accessing lots of it? Well, yes, there are ways of optimizing this so that a whole bunch of the program will be loaded at once, be streamed off disk. This is called pre-linking, and there's a whole bunch of stuff. But yes, it can be slow. But this is one way you get things in your address space, by saying, there are files, I'll map them into memory. And that's what happens for your executable, and that's what happens. It happens to be executable on execve, and it happens for all the libraries by using mmap. So once those are all mapped into memory, for the most part, those are read-only. All the code is normally loaded read-only because, well, on modern systems, you normally do not do self-modifying code. Self-modifying code is possible to do and very hard to read. You avoid it. Except in very, very specialized situations. So let's say I've got this F here. I've got B here, whatever. I've got all these files now mapped in there. One of these might be the C library, the executable, whatever. But what about the data? How do I allocate space for the data I want to use while the program is running? One way to do it is with, what will happen is you'll map in, I forget actually how static data is done. I'll have to check that. I think what happens, it probably gets mapped in as a file in mark read only, but disconnected from the file, but that doesn't matter. You've got, we'll say we want this area . This is the one we want to do read plus write on this region.
This is in high memory. Top of memory. Yes? Malloc is, I'm certainly going to talk about malloc in this context. But I'm going to explain malloc in here. So, but yes, so malloc and stuff is what you're going to do in the data area. The files or stuff are you get mapped in here, and then you manage this. But it's more than malloc. What it is that you have this data area. And in this data area, from the top of memory down to some amount, is two things. One is stack. One is the heap. Yeah. Does it have to be done this way? No. But it turns out these things have distinct uses, and it makes sense to have both. The fundamental purpose of the stack, this is for the function call stack. So this is when you're in function A, and function A calls function B, and function B calls function C, and function C calls function D. How do you figure out where you were? When function D finishes, how does it resume function C where it was? When function C finishes, how does B continue from where it was? When B finishes, how does A continue from where it was? That's a stack. When you enter a function, you push it on the stack. You exit the function, you pop the return address off the stack and continue whoever called you from where they were.
Could you grow the memory?
I'm gonna get to that in a second. Yes, we have to manage this memory. That's exactly what we have to do. The operator to do this. But I'm talking about how you manage this. So you have the stack. You have to push things onto the stack whenever you call a function. And when the function finishes, you pop it off the stack. Since you're already having to push return addresses on and off the stack, you could also push a little more onto it. And so what also gets put onto the stack is arguments for a function and also local variables. Because when you finish a function, you don't need its local variables, so you can just pop them off. So just when you get rid of the return address. Same thing with with the arguments. You don't need the arguments when you're done, so you can just pop them off the stack. So the storage associated with functions, specifically, return addresses. Arguments, local variables. So when programming in C, it is possible to make your just about all of the storage that you do in a C program be on the stack. You can write programs that have that just pass everything via the arguments and do everything with local variables, and that's your entire program. But there's one fundamental limitation about using stack. What is that? Size is just a side effect. You could make the size arbitrarily. The reason why we limit it, but you could in principle make it up very large. More fun than that. It means that data can only persist for the scope of the function in which it's allocated. So you could allocate a bunch of stuff in main. And main allocates it all in its stack, and then it's going to be accessible for the duration of the program because when main exits, everyone exits. But if you allocate it in any other function as a local variable, that local variable goes away. Now, it goes away in a very annoying way because you could still maintain a pointer to it. It's just that it's going to be used for something else. So the basic thing is you can return pointers to local variables. Don't do it. It's a very bad thing to do in C because you can't, because the local variables live on the stack and things are constantly pushed and popped off the stack. And if you return from the function, it will still be on the stack and now you're in big trouble. So this is for, so it's for short term. Say for short term state. What's the function that we're currently running? What local variables it needs? But if there's something for short term, I bet you need something for long term. That's the heap. So the heap is where we stick data structures. So means data structures with arbitrary so data structures that you allocate on the heap can be short-lived. They can be very transitory, or they could be very long-lived. They could be around for the entire duration of the program's execution. If the program runs forever, it could be forever. So with the stack and heap, so this is 0. This is the IMEM. We say the stack. So we have this one region of memory where we say the stack grows from the top of it and the heap grows up. So what happens if the heap runs into the stack? That's bad. Overwriting things. Don't do that. Now, most of the time, the amount of room that you normally have a good amount of space from the stack, this won't be too much of a problem. And actually, these are oftentimes what you actually do is, while these are growing like this, you may make sure there's a little space here of invalid memory so that if you hit that, you don't have to allocate it. These are all details that are taken care of behind your back. And how different libraries do this is different. Yes? Are these implemented by the C library or by the operating system? Given the previous discussion, is that a well-formed question? Fundamentally, this is inside the address space. Are the questions of how this is done determined by the kernel? No. They are determined by the libraries you load in your address space. This is normally managed by the C library. And so your C call stack will grow from high memory down. Your heap will grow up. What happens when you run out of space? That's what S-break is for. S-break is fundamentally about moving the heap down. You say, I need more memory. So move this and move it up here. That's what the. So now we have more space to grow the heap. We can now start allocating objects here. Doesn't that take over the space? How big is the space? So if we're talking about a 32-bit address space, we've got 4 over a billion addresses. So you start putting programs in lower, you know, in the lower address space, doing all the mmaps lower memory, and you allocate the heap from the top of memory. Normally, you'd have plenty of space. If your program starts running into, you start wanting gigabytes of memory to access, yeah, you're gonna run into problems. And it starts getting really annoying. So that's why you move to 64-bit addresses. So now, do we have lots of space here? Yes. We have lots of space. Plenty of space. And in fact, you could say this kind of allocation model might actually get a little bit limiting. Because I've got this big chunk of memory here. What happens when you do a malloc? You know, a malloc says, okay, you can have a pointer to this part of the heap. Well, all that malloc says is here, you can have a pointer to this part of the heap. You now have this part of memory for this data structure. And when you call free, it's, you're telling the C runtime, say, I don't need that memory anymore. What happens if you, what can very easily happen is you start accessing memory, you keep, you know, creating things, keep freeing things. C runtime will try to be smart in how it places these things, but you can easily fragment the memory. Now, given how large the address spaces are nowadays, especially on 64-bit systems, fragmentation is not necessarily a huge problem, except that you may end up wasting memory. So when you start, when you look at later on at memory allocation issues, we talk about the kernel doing fancy things with memory allocation. And that's because it has to solve this kind of problem of everyone asking for little bits of memory on a much larger scale. But all those problems can exist inside of a program that's, say, running multiple other programs, like, say, inside of a web browser. So they potentially have to have very sophisticated ways of managing the heap. Malloc is not sophisticated. Malloc just assumes you know what you're doing. And in fact, programs that do a lot of dynamic memory allocation often implement their own custom memory allocators, where they'll only use malloc to get big chunks of memory, and then inside of that, they'll carve it up into smaller pieces and hand them out in other ways in order to better manage them.
Managing the memory by like system call, or how fast is it to like move whatever you malloc to the top of the
stack? So again, who's in charge of what? When you do S-break, that changes the... So why can't I just access the memory over here? It's because the kernel doesn't know it's valid. When you run S-break, you say, I want to move this up, say, 5 megabytes. So now an additional 5 megabytes of address space is now available for doing mallocs. The kernel doesn't care what you do. Just say, okay, you want that more memory? Fine. We'll have to decide whether it's going to give it to you because this is a real allocation of resources and it might decide to say no. But assuming it succeeds, you now have this memory with which to manage. But now how it's managed, how does malloc? Malloc is completely within the address space. It's a function call. It may end up calling S-break behind the scenes when it runs out of memory, but to a first approximation, it's just a function call managing things. Now, how does it move things around?
Or is it fast when it does?
If the memory's already been, if it doesn't have to call S-break, malloc can be fast. Depends on the malloc. Different mallocs do different things. Some of them try to be a little fancy in how they do things because you have issues like what happens if you mess up in your allocation? What happens if you accidentally free something and then use it? Use after free is a really good way of corrupting your entire address space, or at least corrupting the part that you can write to all your data. It's a good way to get security vulnerabilities. People can arbitrarily take over your program. But so some malloc implementations try to put things into here to help you detect those kind of problems. But malloc cannot just move around data behind the program, because all it gives the program is a pointer. The pointer is a reference to an address. Malloc can't go around and change that pointer and say, oh, now you're actually pointing to somewhere else. If you want to be able to move memory around behind things,
be able to do compaction and stuff, you can't give it a direct memory reference. You have to give what's known as a handle. A handle is a pointer to a pointer. So, okay, when you have to access memory, you have to first reference the handle to get the pointer and then follow the pointer to get the actual memory. Is that a pain? Yes. Have systems used that before? Oh, certainly. Do some programs today use them? Yes, certainly, where they have certain kinds of memory things, but it can slow things down if you have to constantly be doing these extra deep references. What I'm trying to explain is memory management is hard. Memory management inside of a process is hard.
What's the modern solution for dealing with this?
Nope. So where's the real problem? The real problem of this is that I'm allocating. So you've got the heap. Heaps, if I say this is my heap, I've got here, I've got this, I've got this. I've got all these data structures I'm sticking in the heap that have different lifetimes. This one, okay, now this one's gone. Now I want to reuse this memory. And I stick something in here smaller. Now this one goes. And then I want to allocate something this size again, a bigger one. Is there room for it in here? No, I can't stuff it in. But if I compacted everything, I might have room over here. Am I screwed? Maybe. Depends on the implementation. But modern systems, modern programming environments, if you're talking about things like Java or JavaScript or Python or whatever, the higher level languages, they don't rely on something as primitive as malloc to do memory allocation. They don't rely on your program having to manually free memory. You don't do these free things in higher level languages. What do you do instead? You just allocate it and go. So how does memory get reclaimed? Garbage collection. When people talk about garbage collection, garbage collection is the collective result of programmers going, I hate managing memory. And what do programmers do when they find a task that they hate doing? They automate it. They make a program do it for them. And that's what a garbage collector is. It collects the garbage, which is memory. And you say, okay, I've allocated this memory for a data structure. Am I done using that data structure? Well, let someone else determine that. If I'm done using that data structure, then reclaim it. I don't want to have to manually call free. That's a pain. That's why whenever anyone says C and C++ are primitive programming environments, what they're saying is you're responsible for doing programming tasks that in other environments have been automated away. And programmers who do not value automation are not real programmers. You should always value this. And in fact, if you're writing a complex C or C++ program, one of the things you'll typically do is write your own memory allocator. It may not be doing garbage collection, but it'll do something to manage the memory so you don't have to think about it most of the time. Because if you don't, you're in pain and your program is not going to work well. So, any last questions? We're out of time here. Okay, I will stop there.